Life is so much more than a diagnosis. It's about sharing time with those you love, hanging with friends who lift you up, and experiencing all those moments that bring you joy. All hits, no skips. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you. So long live singing to the oldies, jamming out to something new, and everything in between.
We're going to find out about footwear trends on this edition of the Carolina Outdoors, along with one of the number one knives sold in the history of the world since 1890. Those are our two topics. We're glad that you're joining us. I'm Bill Barty, going to lead the way through this. You can hear this program. If you miss any of it, jump over to jessebrowns.com. Do a little shopping while you're there, too. Father's Day weekend is upon us. Welcome, everyone, to the Carolina Outdoors. Your host, Bill Barty, on this side. As you join us, however you may be joining us, whether you're listening to us via the airwaves of WBT Radio up and down the Eastern Seaboard early on a Saturday morning, or maybe many of you are joining us via podcast, welcome all to the Carolina Outdoors, where we come in tackling different topics, different categories, different people coming onto the program to share their knowledge of what is going on in the Carolinas, what's going on trending in the marketplace, and what's going on across the country and across the world. This segment is going to be no different. We're going to have a little bit of an educational moment, too, but the topic is going to be footwear. TJ Boggs on the other side, not to put you on the spot. The difference between a podiatrist and a podorthist.
Oh, man. I've only heard of one of those words for today. So
podiatrist, we'll start with that one. That is a doctor that specializes in the treating of foot and ankle problems, where a podorthist, that's your new word.
Okay.
That's a footwear specialist that creates or modifies shoes, socks, orthotics that aid management and recovery from various foot problems.
Ah, excellent. Okay.
So mark that down. Now, our guest, as we come in to talk about trends in footwear and what's happening in footwear, is a 30-year veteran. He was a trained podorthist in his earlier life, but he's been in footwear with feet and with shoes and boots for 30 years with Adrenaline Sports Marketing, tackling the entire Southeast and then some. Trainer, athlete, and sales. He's joining us now. Kev Martin, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you, Bill. Thank you, TJ. Appreciate it.
Kev, it's always good to get you on here. You're no stranger to the Carolina Outdoors, but footwear is an ever-evolving category. And, of course, in the active realm of outdoor, well, I should back up and say footwear trends always. There's fashion, there's style, there's function, there's support, there's protection. There's many more other reasons that we wear footwear. And in the marketplace, the world marketplace, I think it's $392 billion in 2022 took up the spends. So it's a big business as well, footwear is. But, Kev, you've been a part of it. Primarily, I would say, on the active side, active and or recovery side of footwear. And I know you've seen those different trends of style. This means the platform, elevated look that people wear, down to the minimal footwear that people sometimes wear. Kev, what's going on in the marketplace right now as far as active and or recovery footwear?
Wow, that's a broad spectrum type answer, because there are so many dynamic things happening with footwear. You see the elevated platforms, as you mentioned, the extra material between you and the surface you're standing or running or walking or hiking on. And then you see the other end of the spectrum, which are more the barefoot style shoes that have a minimal. And a good analogy would be the difference you might feel in a sports car, sitting in a firm bucket seat, feeling connected to the steering and the chassis and henceforth the road, versus sitting on a city bus or the bench seat of your grandfather's old pickup truck, where it's much more broad and cushy. You might feel a lot of the bumps along the way, but it's not as connected of a feel. And then there's every place in between. And so what a Pedorthos really does is, and a lot of the shoe stores in the country, the better ones, they often referred to as sit and fit stores. They are trained in sitting you down and sort of interviewing you and your life and your feet. They want to look at your feet after all. Starting there, they can gain information and data about, you know, what are the things you deal with. Have you sprained your ankle when you were a kid? You know, did you break a foot skiing in Vail, you know, 20 years ago? Or do you wear hiking boots a lot? And learn a lot about what your preferences are and what are the things you maybe don't like about shoes you buy or have worn. There's a million things that can come up, but the Pedorthos then is, or the trained fit and sit person in a shoe store is looking for shoe styles and brands that best match the biology or the biomechanics of your body and your foot. After that comes vanity, you know, and fashion and style,
yes,
of which there's no limit. In my career, it's true, I've grew up in the islands of South Florida, and if I was wearing shoes at all, I was wearing flip-flops, maybe topsiders, and then eventually wearing cleats on a soccer pitch or a football field. And, you know, have seen the athletic side of things really evolve through the last couple decades, several decades, in terms of how much cushion there is, how much support. Of course, Nike has brought things to market that actually can help you run faster in a linear kind of way, A to B. But I think what a lot of people are looking for, especially since the pandemic, is a way to become more connected to their environment. Think more lateral movement, not just walking heel to toe, but almost like a side of your foot, like you were be moving from sideline to sideline on a tennis court, or maybe if you were playing defense on basketball, in basketball. That lateral movement is what we don't get so much of, and that's the part of the footwear industry I'm most interested in, because we're involving all 100 moving parts in your foot.
Wow, well said, including the 100 moving parts of the foot. I guess that's the 28 bones, 30 joints, and more than 100 muscles, ligaments, and tendons all in there. TJ thinks that I have this on the top of my head, Kev. I'm reading it off a piece of paper.
You had me fooled.
But there are a lot of moving parts in there. And, Kev, some of the things you just said really intrigue me. And I've got another little word game, and you both can play. It's the difference between science and art. And it's going to come back to you, Kev, and talking about you know, taking care of one's feet, recognizing the problems, trying to solve those problems. But then maybe you don't solve it right away. Is being a podorthist or being a footwear expert sometimes part science, which is designed to be objective and guided by data, where art is subjective and deeply influenced by feelings and opinions? Does that sometimes go along? I know art is partly in fashion of footwear, but is there a bit of it in the function of footwear as well, solving that problem that might not be quite quantified by data? There's a bit of trial and error, and tell me what you feel when you put these on.
You want me to tackle that one, or TJ, you want to go first?
I'm going to let you go with that.
Kev, you're the super train one. TJ's over there pushing
red
buttons.
I just wear shoes. That's all. That's it.
Well, that's good.
He's got Velcro on his.
The most, I'd say, probably obvious one is with the finer gender of women that wear heels, mm-hmm, or where, you know, the fashion forward styles, more contemporary, where the heel is lifted. And you could say men who wear work boots that have a pronounced heel, or you think of the traditional cowboy boot. Yeah. You know, we're built and we come into this world with not wearing shoes, obviously, and that's what we're designed to, how we're designed to work and operate on a natural surface more all the time. And our body is actually designed to last about 100 years. If you, you know, by the science data, you know, the wear and tear of the ligament and the muscle and tendon on bone relationship, we could get 100 years out of our bodies if we take care of ourselves. And we all probably know someone who's made it close to that or over that. But we do things to sort of handicap ourselves along the way, right? We live on concrete. Yes. We wear elevated heels, and what that does is pitch the pelvis forward, which causes the spine and the shoulders and the neck to compensate with the angle that we hold them at, which means that our muscles have to respond to that. So years and years, we don't just, these things, ailments of the foot and sometimes the leg, the hip, the back, they don't just happen overnight. Now, if you have a blunt force trauma or impact, yeah, of course that can happen, but most of it we do to ourselves over repeated, we're creatures of habit, and we do these things for years and years, and that's what leads to things like plantar fasciitis, heel spurs, bunions, you know, putting shoes on that may not necessarily fit. We talk a lot about a lot of the fallacies in the footwear world, and one of them is simple. We really don't wear or buy shoes by the numbers. When you walk into Jesse Brown's Outfitters, by the way, you know, you guys are great, because when you walk in and a customer would like to look at some footwear, you don't really ask them what size do they wear and then go grab a bunch of boxes in the back. Anybody can do that, but right, we really don't buy shoes by the number. That number we all carry around in our head is just an index number. So, and it can differ, right? You might wear a 10 in Reebok, but you might wear a 10.5 in Vasque or a 9.5 in Salomon and so forth. So that is really, you know, one thing that we have to consider when we go into a better footwear store who can sit you down and measure you. Ideally, what they're doing is measuring you while you're seated, with no weight on your foot, and kind of see what your foot looks like in a unweighted situation. And then the dynamic measurement is when you stand up, and often people's feet look like they grow sometimes a size or even two sizes on the Brannock device, and yes, they might spread out in width also. That's where a podorthos may enter the picture, or may offer custom orthotic that could be used to help the plantar fascia ligament shore up the length of the foot, make the footwear more comfortable. Because after all, footwear is the best example in humankind, really, in human history, of a bell-curved, mass-produced product. Right. So but all of us are different. All of us have, you know, different issues, and sometimes one foot's a little bigger than the other, longer than the other, whatever. And that is where the shoe, stops, and that's where the fitting comes in. So that's one way to think of how science versus, you know, fashion may you know, control the things that we buy.
I think that is well said. TJ, he just wrapped it up in a pretty package and with a ribbon on top.
That made sense to me, but can you say plantar fasciitis on the on radio? I'm not sure.
Beep that part out.
Gotcha.
Plantar beep. Fasciitis.
Yeah, you got it.
The one thing I heard
from Latin. Plantar from Latin, meaning against the ground, and fasciitis meaning sheath. So if you, and you can do this on your own, you're sitting down, take your shoe off and put your foot over your other knee, like you're crossing your legs, pull your toes back, and take one of your hands and feel along the bottom of your foot, and you'll feel this band. It feels like a guitar string actually becomes taut as you pull back on the toes, and that's the plantar fascia. And when it's subjected to strain and overtension for literally years, ligaments and tendons really aren't made to stretch a whole lot. Now, we can tear a muscle, you know, pull a ligament, but really or a tendon, But the body's natural reaction, the brain says, I can't deal with this anymore. So it will send messages to the skeletal system and literally calcify more material on the front end of the heel bone, the calcaneus bone. And on an X-ray, it looks like a hook or a spur. And that is designed to take tension off of that plantar fascial ligament, hence the term heel spur. It can be very painful. I'm sure anyone listening who's experienced this knows exactly what I'm talking about.
Hey, I've got a question, because as you were going through that, well, a little side note, part of the beauty of what you said in art was, a foot measured may tell you that foot size, but it will not tell you the actual shoe size, because shoe sizes vary with even brands. Different styles of shoes within brands can vary. So your foot size compared to the shoe size can vary. That's one thing that makes it an art by itself. But, Kev, the other thing that you mentioned is you started talking about pelvises and knees, I think, and ankles. All of that starts at the bottom of the foot, right? So it starts in the arch and works its way up, so it can affect you. The support and protection involved with the footwear that you wear affects your ankles, affects your knees, affects your hips, your pelvis, your lower back. All of that starts at the foundation. Am I right?
Exactly right. Exactly right. Your second grade teacher would be very proud of you.
Yeah, I don't know.
it definitely is a trickle up effect. What we do to the foot, and at the other end, when we add a backpack, maybe we add a book bag. Mm-hmm. Students in school, this is when they first sort of experience, strain as their bodies are developing, and they've already added 20 pounds of books on their back. We do it with backpacks. We do it with briefcases over one shoulder going through the airport. But yes, it definitely starts at the foot. So what happens at the arch, and that is another sort of fallacy we could touch on. It's kind of a rabbit hole, but there really is no such thing as arch support in the foot. We often, I think we're looking for a shoe with good arch support, but I can tell you, I can name all 28 bones in the foot, and I assure you, not one is called the arch bone. There are a series of, four bones in the arch, but they all work together. They all have to sort of rely on each other for the inferences and the data they receive through the proprioceptive cells on the bottom of our foot, the sole of our foot. And if you've walked on the beach and you've seen the print that a foot leaves in the sand ahead of you, or maybe on wet foot on a pool deck, same thing. We're all a little bit different. But the arch only does what the heel tells it to. So looking at the skeletal bones of the foot, the calcaneus really controls what the arch does. Just like the Roman aqueducts of thousands of years ago, they're still there, many of them. They actually get stronger the more weight you put on them. There is a stone at the very top of the aqueduct called the keystone. If you mess with that, you pull that stone out, yes, it will collapse. And what some footwear does is it actually aggravates or messes, sort of distracts the bones of the arch of the foot. And eventually, it feels good in the store sometimes, yes, but eventually your foot's like, wow, this is too much. This is too much arch support. And for those listeners who've ever worn brands like Birkenstock, which, a lot of course, Jesse Brown's customers have those, or yeah, Chaco, or Mephisto, Neiman, there are numerous. These all share a common build, which we call a rigid heel counter. That heel counter, where the heel sits in a pocket, kind of resembles a bucket seat of a sports car. It's firm, but it's got shape to it. And that's what keeps the heel bone, the calcaneus, in alignment with the shin and, the tibia and the fibula, hence, the femur and then the pelvis, and it all starts to line up. It's when we don't have support, or we're in a shoe that has no heel support or heel counter, especially on a flat, hard concrete surface, when the body has to sort of compensate. And we're made to compensate, right? That's what we do. But for years, doing that for years and years and years in the same environment, the body starts to adapt and not always in a good way. And that's again back to when plantar fasciitis can come in, or heel pain, or hip pains come in, lower back, L1, 2, 3, 4, SI issues. You know, the list goes on. But yes, it definitely starts at the foot and it trickles up.
Well, I have to ask you, because if you're just joining us here on the Carolina Outdoors, the voice right there is Kev Martin. Adrenaline Sports Marketing is his company. For over 30 years, he's worked in the footwear business and on feet as well. Kev, with that being said, because we're running low on time, we got to do this more often. At Jesse Brown's, and you cover the Southeast, working with stores, with companies, and two of your brands, Five Fingers being one of the Vibram companies. That is back to basics. That is a company that's celebrating minimalism. And I guess just like that aqueduct, the more weight you put on it, the more you exercise those muscles, the stronger that they get back to the natural setting. Am I
absolutely
platforming that okay?
Absolutely. You're dead on. Yeah, the more you can use, used to be isolate and train was the way we thought of any kind of muscle training or strength training, but now it's much more comprehensive. You want to get all your muscles, ligaments, tendons, and bones involved. It's more of a range of motion. And as I said earlier, when the pandemic came along and we couldn't go to the gym or can go anywhere, our Vibram Five Fingers became very popular because people wanted that grip so they could do Pilates, yoga, you know, different kinds of isometric exercises at home and still have the support and protection of their foot. And for those who don't know what Five Fingers are, it's really almost like a glove that is a very minimalist in build, and they cover your foot and protect it. But the benefits that are associated, it's reduced risk of injuries, enhanced performance, you have a more natural feel. Anybody who loves to be barefoot, you know, loves Vibram and Vibram Five Fingers.
I mentioned Five Fingers. Furoshiki is the other one. I guess that's a sister company within Five Fingers and Vibram.
It is.
And it kind of has a taco wrap to a degree without the toes separated, but it still has that minimalist concern to it.
Yes. The Japanese burrito, we sometimes call it.
Yeah, that's what I was going for.
It's a wrap, and it's unique. Furoshiki, a word derivative of, everybody did origami when they were kids, and that's the Japanese word for folding paper. Furoshiki is the Japanese word for folding cloth. And that's where the stylism of the shoe comes from. It has a right side and a left side, and it sort of folds over your foot in two leaps and lets the toes expand. It's, again, a very minimalist shoe feel. It's great for kids because mom doesn't or dad doesn't have to deal with laces.
Yes.
Sit down and get them attached, and you can go. But for travelers, for lightweight travelers who want to stay, you know, minimalist, it's a great solution. And they're pretty stylish. They've been in a lot of movies lately.
And there's that, too. Kev Martin, Adrenaline Sports Marketing. You are a gem to be on here. I know you're a busy man, especially with a footwear season in full effect. Thank you for jumping on the Carolina Outdoors and sharing your knowledge. Come on in. The listening is fine. The Carolina Outdoors is now in session. We're glad that you are joining us, however you may be joining us, via WBT up and down the Eastern Seaboard early on a Saturday morning, or maybe you are listening via your time, via podcast, available wherever you garner your podcast, listen to podcast. Or also, the third choice, jessebrowns.com. Just click over there and jump on there. Highlights of the Carolina Outdoors. Hi, everyone. Your host, Bill Barty. Each week, we come in and break down four different segments for your listening pleasure. We talk about things to do in the outdoors. We talk about the gear and equipment of the outdoors. And we talk about the people that are making things happen in the outdoor adventure and active world. And this segment is going to be no different. We're going to have a bit of a history lesson with a question. TJ the DJ Boggs is on the other side of the glass. He's unexpectedly a participant in this quiz that's going on. What's one of the most sold knife companies in the world? I bet you can't guess.
Oh, I definitely couldn't guess.
I don't have multiple choice for you.
Yeah.
But many of our listeners are still in the bed. Many are driving into work. Many are doing something active. And TJ, as you are mulling over one of the most sold knife companies or one of the most sold knives by a company in the world, many of our listeners are trying to guess as well. But we're going to talk about that knife company during this segment of the Carolina Outdoors. The company, it was started over 132 years ago in a knife maker's workshop. That was 1890. The knife maker was 18 years old, and against the family's wishes, he began work on the making of a small pocket knife. Now, account manager in the United States of this said knife company is on the line. We're going to invite him onto the program to find out a little bit more of the history. But Ben Cannell is going to join us right here on the Carolina Outdoors. Ben, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. I did not say where this knife maker's workshop was, but I'm going to give the workman's name, the knife maker's name, the 18-year-old's name, his name, Joseph Opinel, and the knife that he made back in 1890, affectionately known as the Opinel Number 8. And Ben, with all of that coming on, you coming on to the program, you are the Opinel account manager. Talk to us about that company and its long heritage, because after, in fact, with my math, it's not 132 years, it's 133 years.
Ooh.
It's been one of the most sold knives in the world. How many knives has Opinel sold since 1890?
So it's a very impressive number. We've sold over 300 million of our knives since 1890. And you're right, we're about 133 years old at this point. The company was started in the French Alps. You mentioned the French Alps, of course, but like the little town or little village, should I say, where Joseph Opinel created the first number 8 was called Saint-Jean-de-Maurienne. And it's about an hour and a few minutes away from Chamonix, from the Mont Blanc Valley of France.
Well, and Ben, I need to ask you about that, because what is it about that part of France? Well, the Alps is one side, southern France as well. You know, those places are known for food, wine, cheese, but it's also known for knives. Why is that? Why is it that that part of France, whether it be the Alps side, the southern side, why is it known for all four of those, food, wine, cheese, and then knives? What? Is that tool an active part of the culinary side as well as being a utility tool?
Well, it's a very good question, and I'll do my best to try and answer it. So I would say for the first aspect of your question, which is like the culinary aspect, I think this region is not stealing that much from the rest of the country. We're pretty renowned for our food and wine, obviously.
Right.
I'll say that this region has definitely a rich heritage in terms of food, especially like in the cheese category.
Yes.
And in terms of knives and tools, it's true that like some of the most renowned knife brands in France are originated in the mountains in this area, as well like further west. I'm thinking of our friends over at Lyell, for example. But as for like why in those areas specifically, I'm not too certain. Like what is true is that we have a very large tradition of craft machine as well in France that goes beyond the food industry. And those tools obviously were made like from father to son and kept like going from a generation to another. And it so happened that this area of France has like quite a bit of those heritage brands.
Well, and that company, Opinel, is worldwide. Their knives are sold in over 70 countries around the world. And again, starting from that family workshop to a company that is essentially global. With that being said, Ben, are the supplies made in the creation of these knives, are they primarily French, the carbon, the stainless steel, or even the wood and inlaid wood that is used in some of the handles, is that French or is it garnered from other parts of the world?
So it's a very good question. No, we still have actually, so the original work workshop is now our museum, and we have a factory that's only a few miles away in Chambéry, in a city called Chambéry in France. And as of now, we probably have 88% of our tools and knives that are produced like in France or in Europe. We have done a good job at sourcing like other elements, especially our steel, for example, is coming from different parts of Europe, depending on the different like blends we've got. Mm-hmm. But it'll be like Sweden and Germany, for example. And we're definitely one of those companies that are, you know, keep our pride in making or assembling our products like as much as we can in the factory over in France that hire over 100 people. Some of those workers have been with us for over 50 years, and it's a very well-run factory, which allows us to keep our costs and prices so low, which is part of like what makes our pride.
Well, and that's something worth noting too, because we're not talking necessarily about super expensive price points on this. Opinel, like the number 8, is still in the teens, I think. U.S. dollars, as it is at Jesse Brown's, I think it may be $18 there. We can look it up at jessebrowns.com.
But maybe between $17 and $20, depending on like the wood finish and the kind of blade. But it's definitely like around $20. And that's something, I just mentioned it, but I'm happy to repeat it because it's something we're really proud of.
Ben, with that, I wanted to also ask you about the evolution of the knives, and not that you're that old of a person, but you mentioned that there are people in the factory that have been there for 5 decades or so. Of course, the company, as I mentioned in the open, started in 1890. But talk to us, I'm going to still put you on the spot, even though you aren't that old, to put you on the spot about the evolution of the knife, because the knives from Opinel have been updated along the way, and one of them came from the inventor, Joseph Opinel, who manufactured that very first small pocket knife. I think it was his son in 1955 incorporated the use of a, and you may have to share this, the Vero Block system.
Vero Block, yes.
Vero Block, which for our listeners out there in the Carolina outdoor world, is essentially a safety, a lock on the knife to keep it from closing. Am I right about that? Was that 1955?
That is correct, 1955. Yes, in fact, I mean, going back to our founder, Joseph, the shape of the blade, the shape of the knife, as you know it, mm-hmm. hasn't changed since then. We have actually internally, like an archive, and I've been able to compare, like side by side, a knife from early 20th century to like the knife that are going out of the factory today, and they are exactly the same shape of handle as well as shape of blade, which Joseph was inspired by a knife from Turkey, actually, from the Ottoman Empire. It was called Yatagan, sorry. Pardon my Turkish here.
you get a credit. You're good. Your Turkish accent is perfect.
Perfect. I appreciate it. And yeah, so like that kind of folding knife and shape hasn't changed, as I was saying. And then in 1955, his son came up with this locking mechanism, which, as you were saying, is nothing but like a locking ring that you twist and lock the blade in open position. That was the innovation from 1955. And then 3 decades later, we innovated, which was basically like cutting this ring with another angle so that you could lock it in a closed position as well. And what is, you know, the important thing to remember here is that like the innovation over time, you know, it takes a few decades to come up with a very simple innovation that transforms a knife into an even more practical tool, and we're really a testament to what simple innovation is about, right? Like the little thing that will make the knife safer, more efficient, and still the most affordable and best tool you can get for the buck.
Well, it is amazing. If you're just joining us here on the Carolina Outdoors, we've got Openeld Knife Account Manager for North America, Ben Cannell, who's joining us on the program. And we're learning about his company and the knife. The Openeld Company is its name, of course, in the Alps small village and small workshop in the Alps region of France, started in 1890. And of course, France known for so many things, food, wine, cheese, and also knives. Ben, something happened about 20 years ago that really changed the knife industry and changed the travel industry. 9/11 happened in the United States, and TSA and security in airports, and a lot of those sorts of things came about. When some economic risk or change like that happens, the rules and regulations change. You can't carry knives like you could at one time. And at one time, people, you know, had a pocket knife in their pocket no matter where they were as a utility tool. But because of abuse and misuse of that tool, many of us don't get to carry our knives regularly, especially at the airport, especially at sporting events, whether it be a soccer game or a football game or basketball game. Does that change the knife business for you and Openeld, which had a fantastic pocket knife? And if it does, how do you transition away for that to find new business when regulations are put into place against carrying pocket knives?
So we joke internally that TSA probably has the largest collection of Openeld knife in the world.
Yeah.
But in true reality, it's definitely changed, changed the landscape a little bit. But I'll say that before, because we're, I've said this, but I'll say it again, because we're so affordable, yes. It seems like our specific company hasn't been like touched that much. I would actually, dare I say, probably like helped us, well, help because we didn't, not what we needed necessarily, but like the it's a knife that you can lose. Like it's a knife that like you actually will find it. We hear multiple stories of people finding it on trails, and then you know they'll pick it up and use it for another 30 years. I've had someone that tell me the story recently at an event in Arizona. And so what I'm trying to say is, because we're not, you know, our price point is so low, it's not a knife that like you're scared to lose. So you might not remember, to remove it from your pocket. And like it's happened to, you know, all of us. But it hasn't impacted like the business as much as like you would think. On the contrary, I would say that like our business has expanded in very positive ways, regardless of that specific event and the consequences of it. Hopefully over time, me included, like we're, you know, aside from the occasional, mistake, we've gotten better at, anticipating it and, leaving our, pocket knives either at home or taking them in, so as to not, enrich TSA with a larger collection of, pocket knives and similar items.
I know they do have a bunch of knives and a lot of Openeld, and probably the genesis of that question comes from Jesse Brown's Outdoors here in Charlotte and jessebrowns.com, because, Ben, we do have a lot of people who come into that store, into the brick and mortar or jump online, and they buy knives, they buy Openeld, and they buy them oftentimes because the people at TSA took them.
They
accidentally had them in their pocket and they just kind of end up surrendering them, and they'll come back. And it's interesting. We also have a group of people who give Openeld knives away. And again, these knives started in the teens, as Ben said, $17, $18, $19, worked their way up. They have several different categories and several different types of knives. And Ben Cannell, account manager for Openeld Knives, is on the Carolina Outdoors. Ben, with that being said, what are the categories that Openeld is operating in? And let me set this up, because we hear so much about tactical knives, gift knives, culinary knives, utility knives. Is Openeld in all of those categories? And if not, what categories are they working in right now?
Well, and that's a very good question. I would say today we're in pretty much all those categories, even though the brand and the knife itself, like, is definitely more on the lifestyle side of things rather than tactical knives. Although we have a couple knives that, like, we're really proud of, and that took us a long time to develop, the number 12 Explore and the number 8 Outdoor, which they have, like, high-quality, high-grade polymer handle, which are waterproof, as you may imagine. And we've got the same steel we're really proud of with, like, slightly thicker blades and some options, I shall say, that, like, are very, would be specific to, like, certain activities in the outdoor, hunting, fishing, or water sports, to name a few. But those two knives serve this specific purpose and, you know, benefit from the same engineering and passion we put into our products. But the rest of our outdoor line is definitely more of, like, you know, everyday carry slash pocket knives with the same Reese 30 steel that we're known for. In terms of steel, we've got most of our lines now are stainless steel because it's the steel that's, you know, needs the less maintenance. Yes. But we do have a specific, like, line of our classic knives that benefit from, like, the carbon steel, the original carbon steel that we know, that we're known for. And I'm, you know, maybe we'll come back to the blades, but I wanted to also mention that we've got a few garden tools. And the reason why we're doing this is A, because, you know, in our mission to, like, get people outdoor and enjoy activities outside. Actually, Josefo Pinel, our founder, had a line of gardening tools. So we took that again a few years ago, I think about 15 or 20 years ago, and developed some high-quality gardening tools. Another couple of things I mentioned to answer your question is that we have a line specifically for kids, using knives as a tool for education to get kids outside and get to, you know, interact with the elements. It's something that is very important to us. For a very simple and very important reason, is that any French person's first knife is an Opinel. You can ask around your French friends if you've got some, and I'll be happy to be one of them.
Yes,
my first knife was an Opinel. My dad's first knife was an Opinel. My grandpa's first knife was an Opinel. They were very stoked to hear that I work for the business here in the U.S. So we have that really emotional connection to the brand and to the product, and we recently released some products specifically for the kids. And the last thing to answer your question in our line is the kitchen. Obviously, we've talked about this already in this conversation. Yes. Kitchen is very important, a very important part of French culture, and our knives are actually great for food preparing. And so we have a full kitchen line, which you'll probably find less so in your stores because, you know, you're definitely more focused on the outdoor side of things. But those products are actually really great. We've got chef's knives, we've got table knives, we've got, like, a prep knife for cooking, and some of those are used in the used in abuse, in some of the most renowned kitchens, chef's kitchens in the world.
So if you're out eating at a restaurant, you can ask your wait staff if the chef is using Opinel knives back in the kitchen and or maybe at the table as well. Ben Cannell, account manager for outdoor sporting goods for the knife company Opinel, the one of the top-selling knives in the history of the world. Ben, thank you so much for taking time to jump on the Carolina Outdoors with us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me, for giving me this opportunity to talk about Opinel.
Well, it was fantastic to have you. We'll give out the website, and we'll also link over to Opinel, to their link to their site as well, so you can check them out as well as over at Jesse Brown's Outdoors. Off he goes. There goes Ben, and off I go. But just for a moment, we're going to come back on the other side and wrap this thing up called the Carolina Outdoors.
Schneider Tree Care. Expert tree care specialist for WPT and for you.
Always an education here on the Carolina Outdoors. I hope you enjoyed learning a little bit about Opinel knives. Again, one of the top-selling knives in the history of the world since 1890. That company has been with us, started in France. We have them at Jesse Brown's. can check it out at jessebrowns.com. Also, follow us over there at Instagram, Facebook, all those social media networks, Jesse Browns CLT. Also, hey, the trends of footwear. That was something to learn a little bit about, and where support starts at the bottom of your foot and works its way up. Ben Cannell, thanks to him from Opinel Knives, joining us on the Carolina Outdoors, and Kev Martin from Adrenaline Sports Marketing, talking to us about feet and footwear and all that is involved with that. For TJ, the DJ Boggs, this is Bill Barty saying, make the Carolina Outdoors a little bit better than you found it, and pick up your trash.